Welcome to The Vinyl Exam. I'm your host, Keith, and this is episode 148. As Sama makes his way across the country from his Bay Area home to his soon-to-be New Jersey home, what I have for you is an interview he did with DJ Plattern that I edited a little bit here. So this was a long interview, so what you're going to hear today is part one, and then we'll hit you back in 2 weeks with the second part of the interview. Hope you dig it.
My name is Aluji Thorderson, professionally known as DJ Plattern. I am a Bay Area DJ, producer, and promoter. And I've been here in the Bay since the early 80s and have been doing my thing musically since the mid-90s. Doing all of the aforementioned and just trying to keep some important culture alive. I'm originally from Iceland, and we moved here as a family in 83, back and forth a lot when I was a kid, and we laid down our roots here permanently in the Bay after a lot of back and forth between Southern California as well in 94. So from 83 to 87, we were here in the Bay, moved back to Iceland, and when we moved back to Cali, we moved to Southern California. I was there from 88 to 94 and then back up here officially in 94. So,
for sure. It's kind of a bizarre question, but like, you know, can you tell me a little bit more about Iceland and how it compares to the Bay Area?
That's a pretty vast question right there. I don't know how much time you want me to spend on that one, but Iceland is, anybody who's ever been there, it's a world apart for sure. There are certain elements definitely that relate, as far as, you know, the Bay Area is known for you know, well, Iceland's not known for neutral weather, but it's known for, like, you know, clean air and relatively clean air, at least up until recently. Maybe that's changed a little bit, but, you know, there's nature and there's beautiful scenery and there's interesting culture. There's a lot of reverence and respect and for your environment, kind of thing, and those are probably kind of the more straightforward, noticeable things. Culturally, probably not quite as much. Iceland is a very, very Caucasian and homogenous society. The Bay Area, not so much. Again, that's changing a little bit too, of course. I feel like we'd probably be having a different conversation if we were to be doing this interview maybe 10 years ago, but there are definitely, you know, there's some elements. I mean, you know, there's a lot of forward thinking aspects to Icelandic society, just like there are around here. Iceland had a female president for 24 years. They have been supporting gay marriage since a long time ago, decades now. You know, there's definitely some elements, but, you know, it's different. It's pretty different. I mean, Iceland's 6,000 miles away from here, so, and, you know, across, it's halfway between the East Coast and Europe. You know, it's in the dead center of the Atlantic Ocean and whatnot, so.
Right.
Not too many remnants of Viking culture here in the Bay Area, so.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of unfair to compare an entire country.
No, but there are definitely, well, to be fair, though, I mean, the question is definitely, it's relevant because there were reasons why, you know, my parents were attracted to the ideas that they saw when they first came here. You know, they visited a little bit before we actually moved out here. So there's definitely those elements for sure. You know, they saw certain things that I guess would make the transition maybe a little bit easier or something, you know, like what I spoke of. There's the nature aspect and the forward thinking aspect. So those are probably the two main things. So
just like the fact that the Bay Area has been a much more progressive space in the U.S.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, again, I don't want to retract to that too much, but, you know, there is definitely the premise that those elements are not entirely disappearing, but maybe aren't quite as prevalent as they used to be. So they used to be very prevalent. Like, that's what the Bay was absolutely 100% known for, you know, this very forward-thinking, open-minded, very left, very culturally progressive, you know, just we, you know, everybody always talked about the, if you lived in the Bay, you kind of lived in a bubble in comparison to the rest of the U.S. or at least anywhere outside of kind of like major cities, you know, any like you, the big cities in America are the ones where you notice the more progressive thinking elements. Right. But as soon as you step outside of it, it's so, but you know, you step outside of any, what's deemed a major city in Iceland and you just dip into a little country fishing town or whatever, you're gonna see some shit too. Like, if you ever traveled Iceland, like, man, you'll notice it immediately. Like, it's pretty country, man. It's definitely pretty country. So
can you tell me, in your mind, what's changed between 10 years ago and now in the Bay Area?
I think there is an emphasis on things that I wouldn't say that we didn't care about, but weren't quite so in the forefront, as far as our issues, like our kind of main issues that we wanted to deal with. When I was growing up around here, it was never, you know, it's never rosy. It was never like a, you know, everything is just great and, you know, hotsy totsy, let's just go with how things are like, you know, East and West Oakland, for instance, and Richmond, and I mean, a lot of these areas, man, in here in the Bay Area have just been neglected for a long time and have always had their issues, and there's been a violence, and I mean, you know, the 80s and everything, like any major metropolitan area in the United States in the 80s just felt like the, you know, they felt the clampdown of how hardcore, like, crack permeating inner cities and everything. So, like, if you're into the kind of things that I was into,
like what?
Just as far as like hip hop and art and the kind of things, you know, just like inner city culture kind of thing. You know, those were real things that, you know, we had to deal with around here as much as anywhere, but there was an attitude. I think that's probably what it comes down to answer your question, in the most roundabout way possible, is that I think that the attitude, the general consensus of the Bay Area versus how it is now, is that the priorities are just a little bit skewed, just in terms of what it is that we're really concentrating on. Like, I feel like back then there was way more of an emphasis trying to figure out like the most basic of things around here. Like, how do we, you know, how do we make sure that everybody's taken care of? I mean, there's always been a homelessness issue, but like there was a lot of social programs. There was a lot of issues that we had to deal with, just in terms of the hippie movement, the Black Panther movement, all of those things here in the Bay Area, they resonated and they stayed for a very long time in terms of the things that we worked on as a society. And I feel like just a lot of that shit has just gotten thrown out the window at this stage, man. It's obviously really, really, it's sad. You know, now, I mean, people used to move here for a specific reason. The reason why people move here now is just very, very different. You know, the reason why people move to the Bay nowadays, most of the time is to take part in, you know, this third, fourth, fifth gold rush wave or whatever, you know. Now, obviously, with the whole app generation, before it was the .com, blah blah blah, before that, you know, who knows, like, it's just, you know, it's shifted, but our priorities are very different than what they used to be. The Bay Area just used to be known and respected and revered as a forward-thinking cultural hub, very like minority and you know, counterculture friendly, gay friendly, the whole nine. And not that certain aspects of those aren't still around, but the focus and the emphasis and like the the sensitivity towards those things is not nearly as prevalent as it used to be. So I'm trying to be as kind as I possibly can
be
here.
Yeah, I'm noticing.
Because everybody knows, like, if we're really going to speak bluntly, like, San Francisco's fucked up right now. You know, the way that minorities are treated, like black and brown people, the way that they're treated in the city right now. And you're starting to see it more and more and more in Oakland. It's not that it doesn't exist. It's just we're still holding on to it that much more than we used to. But man, it's just getting nasty. It's getting ugly.
Personally, like, so I grew up in Philly, and then coming out here for school, like, I've never been called nigger so many times.
Dude, you know what I mean? That kind of shit was never, ever... So if you've lived any extended amount of time in the Bay, you know that all you got to do is drive a half an hour and you will see Confederate flags and you'll be in the fucking sticks and you can go to Lodi, you can go, you know, a little bit outside of Sacramento, like there's country bumpkin motherfuckers everywhere. But the Bay, the immediate Bay, it was always like, no, that's not what we're here to do. You know what I'm saying? Like, our objective is to make things work. And now that is just not a priority. It's just not a fucking priority, man. People's like heads are in a fucked up place, man. Like, whatever it is that they're trying to accomplish around here. And I mean, all praise be to American capitalism, dude. Like, that's just what everybody is on right now here in the Bay. And like, they're all just trying to get their piece of the pie. And, you know, I feel like anybody who's kind of a remnant of the old school days of the Bay, like, they're either just trying to deal, fight for it, or they're just kind of like slowly sitting by waiting for things to calm the fuck down again. So it's a trip, man. It's a trip, dude. We're such a small area, and it's just kind of crazy to see things change quite so rapidly. Because we're so small, you see some of these changes happen just so damn quickly. And I'm not to take anything away from any other metropolitan area in the Bay or in the U.S. because it's happening everywhere, absolutely. But I think just because we're so small, you know, there's less than 1.5 million people in the immediate Bay Area. You know, if you count Berkeley, Oakland, and San Francisco, there's less than 1.5 million people. And that's, you know, for a viable metropolitan area that garners and produces the amount of influence and money that we do all across the world. Like, it's crazy to think about it. So it's a trip.
That's a really good point, actually. What do you feel? You know, let's work our way backwards here. What do you feel that the current mentality has done for arts and culture and the music in specific? You know, specifically.
I mean, it's direct. It's 100% direct. I don't think art and music are necessarily disappearing, but what it is that is actually talked about and focused on is vastly different. I wouldn't say that there aren't artists around here from all genres. I'll just talk about music specifically right now. Visual arts might be a little bit different. I'm a little bit out of that game, so I don't think I can really speak on behalf of that 100%, but, I think if you dive into, if you go back as far as the 60s, the mid to late 60s, and the things that were being addressed and talked about in lyrics, like, you know, again, we'll just talk about lyrics, for instance, all the way up until, you know, there was just this culture. There was a culture of musicians, lyricists, songwriters, everything down to just progressive ways of music making, different types of styles and instruments and meshing different genres and the whole nine. Like, that was always a part of what we were here and what we concentrated on and were very proud of. Like, we were super proud of that kind of shit, man. I always knew that, like, you know, you think about a band, like, just take a relatively obvious example with something like Sly and the Family Stone, right? A super, super progressive thinking or progressive angle on music making on Sly's behalf, and just with the Family Stone being, you know, from all these different backgrounds and embracing rock and soul and jazz and funk and the whole nine, and like, and really kind of putting it together. Like, that was such a perfect kind of amalgamation of what we would pride ourselves on here, you know, music wise and whatnot. So, but, you know, just with gentrification happening and things, you know, shifting the way that they have been over the years. And, you know, again, like you and I were talking about earlier, it comes in waves a little bit. It's just become a little more homogenous than what I'm personally used to. So again, trying to be as friendly as I possibly can be, because this is, you know, this is still my scene. The Bay is still my home and what I love. And I do everything that I can in my power to just retain some of those aspects, you know, with the things that I try to preserve musically and the, you know, the events that I throw and the music that I make. Like, I'm always very adamant about preserving those aspects, but, you know, it gets harder and harder all the time. Like, it's difficult, man. Like, it's just, I mean, you go, you know, anyone that is a part of the music scene and the DJ scene here in the Bay Area can tell you, that if you take part in any sort of way, like, you're fighting a pretty hardcore, like, uphill battle right now, which is trying to play, like, you know, cool old school shit, and like, take anything away from the whole, like, old versus new thing. 'Cause, you know, there's tons of really excellent and amazing new and interesting good music that deserves to get shine and be played in clubs or bars or whatever here in the Bay. And we still have artists like, dude, like, you know, there's some amazing, there's still amazing things that are coming and happening here. I just think the general consensus is just like, dude, let's just rock out with our cocks out and play some fucking cocaine fueled EDM, bro. And like, you know, whatever, dude, like, let's just, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's just gotten a little too fucking thin. Like, the levels are just, they've just diminished, dude. You know, like, the 7-layer dip has just kind of turned into like 2 fucking layers. You know, it's like, there's one part of the Bay that's just trying so hard to just kind of hold on to good, substantial, timeless, thought-provoking, you know, music and art, and then there's the rest that are just kind of like, whatever, dude, you know? That IKEA, you know, setup looks perfect in my apartment in San Francisco, or whatever, you know? Like, it's all very generic like that. I just feel like the middle ground is kind of, I don't know. I think that's the rest of America, though, too. Like, the divide between the lower and middle class has just gotten that much smaller, you know. Now it's just, you know, the haves are just squashing the have-nots, kind of. So my pops used to be a DJ back in the day. So I grew up around records. My dad had a radio show in Iceland back in the day. Little known fact is my pops, he used to do a radio show for quite some time in Reykjavik back in the day, and was one of the first dudes, along with some buddies of his, to actually play black music on the airwaves in Iceland back in the day. And, you know, when I say that, I don't mean like, you know, playing super cutty 45s and, excuse me, and you know, diving into like, but, you know, that's, that had a lot to do with just the access to music kind of thing. But, you know, they would, he would play a lot of Stevie, he'd play Curtis Mayfield, he would play Motown, and because he played that music and had access to that music, him and his buddies would actually, like, they would do digging trips. Like, they'd go over to London and actually shop at the record stores, bring it back over, and then they would have access to the vinyl that came through the radio stations and the whole nine. Because of that fact, a lot of that music, it got played in my household. And so I listened to a lot of that music growing up, along with just standard stuff. Like, he was kind of a traditional rock kind of dude. The stuff that he was really in, like, he was a big, you know, Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan fan, and was definitely into a lot of that stuff. But you know, those records were all readily accessible to me. And so I listened to a lot of Stevie, man. I listened to a lot of Stevie when I was growing up. All of his seminal albums were all in the household, and my pops was a, you know, he's a big fan of Curtis. He had all of his albums too. And he was also into reggae music, and so we had a little bit of reggae in the house and everything too. So anyway, being that far removed from all of those things, that set it off. And so just being around records and being around that kind of music for my whole life is just kind of what led me on the path. But, you know, as far as me actually trying to kind of distinguish myself and you know, I never really got into making music myself, but just being a DJ and just being a fan of music, it just kind of seemed only natural to go towards that next step when I was able to, you know, start purchasing my own equipment and, like, you know, make enough money to start buying my own records, and then it just blossomed from that. So, but yeah, that's definitely, you know, as much as my parents or my pops might try to, you know, scoff at my choices as far as what direction I took in life, it's like, dude, that's all your fucking fault, homeboy. I mean, that's like, dude, come on, like, really, like, he had thousands of records, dude, in the house, like, growing up. Like, don't think that I wasn't, you know, like, I used to dance around the house, like, the apartment to when we were kids, dude, like, just a little punk, you know, in the apartment back in the day, dude. Like, we used to listen Like, I remember Sir Duke was just constantly on repeat. Like, that was my song when I was a kid. Like, you know, you talk about having those, like, very vague memories, you know, when you were a kid. Like, what are the most... What are the most vivid memories that you have from when you were a kid, where you can actually kind of truly remember, you know, your surroundings and kind of like how you felt or whatever? Like, I remember listening to Sir Duke over and over and over again, and that song was just like everything to me.
So you got started, and I was actually expecting you to tell me something about how living in Oakland in the late 80s, I'm guessing, and in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Something happened there that triggered your start into collecting records and then DJing and then becoming part of the DJ culture here.
Sure.
But you're actually saying it's much, much earlier.
Yeah, it's substantially earlier. Being into the actual art form of DJing, you know, the actual hip hop art form of DJing, I got interested in it way before I was actually able to get my hands on some equipment and start doing it myself. The first time I ever actually got interested in hip hop DJing, scratching the whole nine, was Tougher Than Leather. And every opportunity that I got to actually put my hands on some turntables, be around DJs, you know, the whole nine for, you know, the next 7-8 years after that, I took it. And when I was going to, like, I used to run with a couple of DJ crews in high school and everything, and like, you know, I took part in the culture of it, not to mention, you know, the hip hop culture for as long as and for as much as I could before I could actually start acquiring enough money to purchase my own equipment. So that, I mean, that's essentially what it came down to. It's very possible that if I had some sort of access to equipment or was able to figure out a way to purchase, you know, the gear to get into it, they might've started earlier, but the diving into the art form and actually being able to purchase my own records, that didn't really start until 94. So when I first got into it, the start was a trip, man. So when I graduated high school, I started working with kids. I started working for the YMCA. I worked for the Y for almost 10 years. And that was the first kind of like real steady paycheck where it seemed kind of like a decent amount of money. The first set of equipment that I was actually able to purchase, I bought an Upstairs Records. That was a thing that you could purchase in the back of the Source magazine. Back in that era, man, that's such a trip. Like, you used to be able to buy like a full DJ setup in the back of a hip hop magazine, and Upstairs Records in New York was one of the ones. Like, they had an advertisement in the back of that magazine every single issue. And I used to look at it, and you know, and it was a lot of money back then. If you're like 17, 18 years old, man, that's a lot of loot. I think it was like $500 or something. And I remember, you know, you purchase this ready to go kit. And it was the shittiest fucking rig, man. Like, it was unreal. Like, I remember I owned it for about 3 months. I owned it for 3 months, and then I just got so fed up with it that I ended up selling it. But I had that first rig for 3 months. I remember it was a pair of, not even belt drive, it was direct drive Gemini turntables and a Linear Tech. There was a brand called Linear Tech, which... I mean, unless you were that desperate during that era, there was no fucking way that you would know what that brand is. It was awful. The mixer had these buttons on the left and right hand side of the crossfader, and the buttons were meant for you to press on like a transformer button. So it was called the transformer button, right? Like a transformer switch kind of thing, and it was totally anti-effective because I remember it wasn't like a turn on and off kind of thing. It was, it did this weird thing where it like, it cut it out in like kind of a strange way where I think you would have to tap on it twice in order for it to come back on. Anyway, it was total garbage. And I just got so frustrated because I like saved up all this money, bought this pack. It arrives, you plug it in, got a few records, start trying to do your thing. And you're just like, dude, this is fucking bullshit, right? So anyway, I did it for a few months, and I remember I sold it for like half of what I bought it for. And then I went out and I bought a used techniques from Soundwell on University. And anybody listening to this that knows about Soundwell, and Soundwell, one of the guys from Soundwell is actually still around and has a shop somewhere in Berkeley. I don't know exactly where. But these dudes were open only a couple of days out of the week, and they would sell refurbished stereo gear, and they would have on occasion, there was a list. I remember there was a list, like a lengthy list, to get your hands on a pair of Techniques, or just even one Technique. So anyway, I bought one, and what did I think I got my hands on. Oh yeah, it was the Scratchmaster. It's actually right up there. That thing's been defunct forever. It's right up there on display. I had the Scratchmaster, I had that, and then I had a CD player. And so I just made pause tapes and kind of practiced mixing for like a whole year until I could get my hands on another second Techniques. And so I did that. So it was really Frankenstein style after I had like a quote unquote legit setup that just turned out to be crap. And so anyway, those were the meager starts. And at the same time, I was still going and I was digging a lot. I would buy, like, because I had a CD player, I would buy CD singles a lot still, because they would have the instrumentals and the remixes and blah. And I was making tapes. Like, I was making tapes for people right off the bat and working on actually putting, you know, mixes together. Like, I still, right there, what you see right there in front of you, those are all CD singles. Every single one of those CDs, minus, like, a few of them, those are all CD singles. So I've always, like, I'm still kind of nerd out on the CD single tip. So anyway, those were the humble beginnings. And then, you know, I've been fortunate enough to stick to it. And, you know,
setup that you bought then?
One of them. One of the turntables. The one that's a little more scuffed up. I think it's this one on the right here. Yeah, this is the one. The one of the turntables that I bought, I think it was probably the second. I think it was the second one. I think the first one that I had, I still actually have. And that's crazy.
This is like 21 years
ago. Yeah, I mean, this is 94 when I got it. So that's a trip. Like, that's 22 years ago. And, you know, had a couple of the homies. I just actually got them fully refurbished. Shout out to the homie Ajax, by the way. Just a little plug for the homie Ajax, because he's a gangster dude. He's like the dude in the Bay Area that hooks it up fat. So, but yeah, one of them. But anyway, another one got replaced after a while. So yeah, these, you know, still the staple. So
yeah, they last.
Yeah.
Yeah. So okay. So you got, you know, you did that for a year. And then what happened next?
Radio was probably kind of like the next main logical thing for if you were into DJing in the Bay Area in the mid-90s. The next logical thing was definitely to try and get yourself some airplay on radio. And I mean, radio was just, you know, for a long time, still kind of this day, but I mean, obviously things have changed a lot. with the advent of the internet and whatnot. But back then, if you were trying to get yourself out there, you know, gigs, of course, were you know, they were important, and it was a way for you to kind of get the word out about yourself. But I mean, if you had a radio program that you were actually spinning on or guesting on, or especially if you had your own kind of thing, I'm drinking beer while we're doing this, so this is hence the hiccups. But anyway, that was definitely the next way to kind of up your status in the scene, was to get yourself on the airwaves. So in Calyx, for anybody that was trying to do kind of like, you know, obviously college radio kind of stuff, but you know, there was back in the day, I mean, the Wake Up Show was arguably the most important independent and underground hip hop outlet, for that era of rap music. And that was here in the Bay Area, with Sway and Tech, and it was on KML. And every Friday night you would tune in, and Joe Quicks, one of the, you know, the homies, like OG, he was the OG DJ on the Wake Up Show before Revolution and before all of that stuff. But he was the dude that I would listen to, man, on the radio back in the day all the time, like tune in, record every single time, listen to it all week until it came back on kind of thing, like listen to it in the Walkman all week, on the bus, on the AC, dude, like, you know.
Like religion almost.
I mean, dude, it was like, if you were really into it, man, like you just subscribe to it in such a hardcore way, you know? But that was it. Like my aim was to get myself on the radio. So I started, you know, you start doing, there was a way for you to get onto Calyx where you would go and you would do hours. You would log in hours where you would help.
Yeah. Calyx is the Berkeley.
Yeah. It's the UC Berkeley radio station. Exactly. Still to this day. There's legendary radio shows that went through there, especially during my era. Matthew Africa had a show on there. O-Dub had a show on there. Bunch of homies had a show on there. Billy Jam had a show on there. Like there was a lot of really supportive stuff going down during that era as far as independent and underground hip hop. And I was able to get myself in a position where I guested on shows, but then eventually ended up getting my own show with a homie of mine that we did on Friday mornings, drive time Friday mornings from 6 to 9 a.m. for a whole year. And that was the first time where I was able to actually like really, really get my thing out on a regular basis on the airwaves. And I think that was probably kind of a jump. So shout out to my homie, Robert Maraz, my homie Rock. He's still here in the Bay. He's a lawyer now too. But anyway, that was definitely like the next phase, was to get yourself on the airwaves and just make mixtapes and try to gig out and, you know, do all that. But, you know, get yourself on the airwaves, dude. Get your sounds out to the masses as much as you can. So,
like, how did you know to do that? And also, like, what made you gravitate towards that kind of music?
As far as gravitate towards hip hop, I mean, that was already in place. You know, the hip hop thing, and at that stage, in terms of like making mixtapes and like, you know, the kind of the turntablism, quote unquote turntablism thing that was going on. The reason I say quote unquote is before it was called turntablism, dude. Like it's just, you know, it was just DJing and it was just scratching and whatnot, but. You know, it turned into this thing. The more technology evolved, like cats were like making scratch music, and I mean, a lot of this stuff was already happening in the scene. You know, as far back as the early to mid '90s. You know, like really heady, like layered. You know, get your four track going, and like, you know, do all this like weird scratch music kind of thing. But at that stage, for me personally, along with a lot of the homies that I kicked it with, like we were already diving into the breaks in a big way, you know? And during that era, because we came a little bit later, you know, we weren't focusing so much on say disco 12s or like, you know, really, like hardcore, like B-boy 45s kind of thing. Like we were diving into CTI stuff. Like during the mid-90s, that was definitely like a stepping stone for a lot of cats, was the CTI era, because that's what everybody was sampling at that time. Cats were getting into the more obscure jazz sample stuff. And they were also getting into kind of like the left field, like psych rock kind of stuff that had drums and like funky bass lines kind of shit. So that was the shit that we were super, super into. So me personally, as much as we were collecting hip hop music, and, you know, we were rocking parties and everything too, so we were doing that and playing some old school shit and everything. Like, we were really, like, as far as making tapes and playing on the radio, man, we loved playing the samples, dude. Like, that was everything. And that's, none of that has changed. I mean, that's still very much part of the MO, you know. Even when we do stuff like the 45 sessions, man, like, we just love playing the samples, dude, and letting them breathe, you know what I mean? Like, when you did the tapes and when you did the radio shows, dude, like, you played that music and you let it sit, you know. I remember listening to Joe Quicks play Breaks on the Wake Up Show, and he would play the songs, you know, because the songs were just crazy, but nobody knew what the hell it was. Especially from cats from that generation, you know what I mean? Anybody older that was really into heavy music or whatever, they might have been, you know, into it and known about it, but man, you know, for young kids, dude, like, when you heard, like, I remember he used to play the S-O-U-L Peace of Mind joint. And that was the Peace is Not the Word to Play sample for Main Source. And I just remember hearing that. And the song itself was so incredible. But as soon as that vocal came in, like, you understood that, like, that was the break kind of thing, right? And I mean, that's one example out of many, you know, just to hear like Nautilus on the airwaves and shit like that, dude, like, you know, speaking of CTI and everything, man, like, dude, that was just, it was the best, dude. Man, that era was just incredible, dude. Cause everybody, like, you know, you were able to play these amazing songs on the radio and in your sets and everything. And like, crowds would go apeshit if you played a jazz break. You know what I'm saying? Like, they would lose it if you played a jazz break, dude. Can you imagine trying to do that, dude, for like a jam now? It's so rare that you can pull that kind of stuff out and have people react. But back then, man, you could do that. And like, even girls would just lose it. Like, they would dance to like funky jazz music, dude. That's so fucking weird to even think about.
Please all rise for the occasion. For too much time, you know that we've been pacing back and forth, patiently waiting. You know our holdings a crime. People, you gotta shake it.
Sessions was a very kind of simple and innocent kind of response to what was happening around that time. And so we started in 2010, and during that time, like, vinyl culture was, I wouldn't say it was on its way out, but there was like, nobody was really tripping, like, nobody was really giving a shit about whether or not you were actually playing wax, because it was a few years after digital DJing started, and digital DJing had just basically become it, you know. It was just like a thing at that time that was the standard. It had become the standard. And so, me being a record cat, having collected 45s for as long as I had, having so fucking many of them, still going out, still searching, still having like a genuine passion for it, I just wanted a place to play them, it was really that simple. There was nothing more to it. I just wanted a spot where I could listen to these records that I was still buying loud. That's it. And it wasn't meant to be heady. It wasn't meant to be, you know, counter anything. Like, I wasn't, you know, my objective with starting it back then, man, it was so simple, dude. Like, I wasn't trying to make it into anything or grow it into anything, and I wasn't trying to make a statement in any sort of way. It was just like, hey, I just wanted, you know, like I said, I just wanted a place to play them loud, and that's it. And so we would play, you know, when we first started it, we would just play, like, whatever the fuck we felt like. As long as it was on a 7-inch, it didn't matter, dude. Like when I brought my records out and when I would tell the homies to bring them out, we started it initially. It was me and Anki and Ida Boss were the first residents. And when we first started it, that was the only rule. It was just it just has to be on a 7-inch. And we did it at the layover. I remember we did it at the layover at first. And the layover, it was just a small, it's just like the size of a living room kind of thing. And we would just play whatever kind of got people to dance kind of thing. You know, like we didn't, we would play all kinds of stuff, but like it had to have an energy, you know, like the music that we played had to have an energy. It wasn't like lounge style in the sense that it was being played in the background, because when we initially set it up, we had a dance floor and we had people that we had to entertain. And so we had to make sure that there was some sort of groove going down, you know. And what, dude, honestly, man, there was nothing unique about what we were doing. Nothing at all, dude. Like, I just remember having a couple of conversations over the years with folks where they're like, man, y'all, you know, it was like some real groundbreaking shit or whatever. And I was like, I had to just explain to folks that, like, there was nothing. We didn't do anything unique at all. The only thing that we did different was that just nobody was doing it at that time. That's the only thing, because nobody was really tripping, because it was just that specific time period, you know. But there was nothing original that we were doing. We were just playing 45s. That's it. We just kept at it. It kept growing. Got more and more just... I've had a couple of people kind of point the finger at us playing a role also in the Renaissance resurgence or whatever, you know, of the whole thing. And sure, whatever, you know, it, as entirely unintentional as that was.
You mean the resurgence of vinyl?
Being of just vinyl, just like in a, you know, I mean, I've worked in record stores and been around vinyl for decades, you know, and it's the ebb and flow is real. Like it's up and down, and like vinyl just never really dies. It's the one format that we've had for more than half a century, dude, that will just, it just refuses to go away. More than half, Jesus, it's going on like a fucking century at this stage, you know? Like, vinyl will just not disappear. And no matter what comes along, no matter how smaller the format gets, and now it's just like a fucking, it's, you know, it's a teardrop in the thought of your mind, dude. That MP3 is just whatever, you know? You could fit a fucking, you know, 10 million songs, do it on a USB stick at this stage, you know, but like vinyl just won't go away. It just will not disappear. And I don't think we necessarily played a role in it, but, you know, we just kind of kept doing what we were doing. There was never any preachy aspect to our approach. Like I DJ digitally. So there was never any part of that was like, fuck digital DJing, blah, blah, blah. You know, like I'm not sitting here saying like it's the future or whatever, but like, I'm not like anti-proponent of it in any stretch of the imagination. Like I love the easy aspects too that it brings to the, you know, the back break and the whole night. But like, I also still play records. I still collect records. So. So anyway, you know, 45 sessions, like it just started out as really basic, really simple. And it just kind of grew because I think people just give a shit. They like to just see the fact that somebody's up there like flipping through records. They like the fact that there's like the ooh factor, you know, the fucking, oh shit, he's got that, blah, blah, blah. And there's, I think more than anything, really, like, just seeing it now, like, we're going on almost 7 years. We don't do it quite as much as we used to, but, like, we're more into, like, the specialty shows now, is, like, just do a few a year and make sure that they're really, really high quality kind of thing. Is people just like seeing DJs work, you know? Like, they really dig that. Like, I know that about my crowd and the people that come out and support it, is they really love to see a DJ actually putting in work up there. Like, they like to see, you know, him going through their shit and, like, picking out and, like, queuing up and doing all those things. And they like to see a DJ actually cutting it up. And that, on top of the fact that, you know, in my humble opinion, 45s are never going to, like, they sound better than any other music format that's ever been created. Me personally, and just whatever, I won't dive into that too much, but, like, there are certain physical elements of the pressing of 7-inch vinyl that make 45s the sound quality, just on some audiophile nerd shit, like, 45 sound better than any, like, you know, aside from maybe disco 12 inches, the big Oakman grooves, just the fattiness of the, you know, the wall of sound, like, just kind of coming through the, permeating through the grooves and whatnot, like, there's never going to be a, I don't know, it'll never be replicated as far as I'm concerned, so.
Say also more than just that aspect of seeing a DJ work or the culture around that. It's just a really good dance party.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I could dig that, man, for sure. Like, I, you know, we,
right? Because the other stuff can fade, right? Yeah. People can be like, okay, I've seen this DJ work. I'm gonna, why come next month? But people come back multiple times. You guys pack house.
Yeah,
because it's a fun dance party also.
Yeah, and we've. As much as we just told all of our guests throughout the years and you know, the residents and everything, the objective is to you know, it's about energy. And so we've had artists that have come through and done more kind of like left field stuff throughout the years. We've definitely had some jams where it was more like on the heady tip, and maybe not like 100% geared towards the dance floor. That's a rarity. I mean, most of the time, like, I tell everybody, it's like, dude, I don't give a shit what you play. Play whatever the fuck you want to play. Just know that people are there to dance, you know, and, like, it's a dance jam. but people, the folks that come out, they are there to genuinely support, you know, what it is that the DJ is there to do, and they know that they, you know, piece their set together, that they put some time and they put some thought into their set, and that, I think, is an important element, and definitely, I wouldn't say it's lost. I mean, you know, there are, you know, you could do a digital set and piece a set together and really make it thoughtful and interesting and whatnot, but there is just something so raw and basic about just like, hey, just fucking, you know, throw some records in a bag, dude, and go out and, like, rock that shit, dude. Like, really rock it, where people are just like, holy fuck, you know, all he's up there doing is playing one song each. It's not a, you know, like, he's not up there, like, there's no opportunity for you to throw on a 10-minute jam and go take a piss. It's like, you're up there working, dude. You know, you gotta be sensitive with the format. You got to know how to fucking actually spin it and transition and the whole nine. You got to make sure that your levels are on point, because there's tons of fluctuation with sound and EQing and the whole nine and like all of that shit, all of those like really basic elements of vinyl DJing.
Yeah, for sure. Like, but I see the DJ sweating, like literally sweating.
Yeah, literally sweating. Like, you really see them putting in work, like really, really fucking putting in work. And I think people just are attracted to that. They're attracted to seeing. I think people just enjoy the fact that, like, hey man, I paid some money, dude. Put in some work for me, kind of thing, dude. Like, really, dude. Like, it really comes down to it. It's like, you know, entertain me. If I'm gonna come out and support this, like, I love this shit. I'm really into it, but I want to see, you know, who's in front of me, like, know what they're doing, and like showcase the fact that they gave a shit and put some time into it. So, I'll tell you this. So, one of the things that happened is, okay, so we did a monthly for 5 years, 5 years straight. We did minus, you know, a few months here and there, or, you know, a month or two here and there. We did 60 straight, right? So we ended on our 5 year anniversary, our residency. And we did it, you know, we did it third Fridays for that amount of time. And we had a lot of people that were just diehards and kind of dependent. It was their outlet, you know, the whole nine. Like, it was very, very religious for a lot of folks. I personally decided to scale back on the consistency of it, because there was a lot of hype. There was a lot of things that were changing in the industry. There was a ton of just shit going down that was just like I started seeing 45s parties pop up everywhere, not just in the Bay, but like all over the fucking place, man. The US, like all over the world, like the 45s thing just started getting a little goofy, in my opinion. And so anyway, I decided to dead it. We took some time off, but there was something that was still very important and kind of the meat of the why we did it in the first place. And that was really just the music, you know. The music was like the really the 100% the reason behind it, you know. The thing about 45s is like, you gotta pay for that shit, man. Like, it takes a long time. What ends up on a 45, like, you really kind of have to, especially nowadays, if you're pressing up new vinyl, is like, you kind of have to like really give a shit. Like, you have to give a shit a lot in order to take the time to put the effort and the money into making them, right? And so it's very, very specific, the music that makes it onto. And so the older music too, obviously. So you put those two together, you couple them together, and you have this kind of specific wall of sound that you get from a 45s party. And anybody that's part of that culture, or any DJ that's a part of it, like, will tell you the exact same thing. It's like, dude, we just focus on shit that is generally regarded as what's considered timeless music, right? And so timeless everything, hip hop, funk, soul, boogie, disco, whatever the fuck, you know, rock or whatever, like, it's all music that for a you know, a certain point in time, but like it just resonates throughout the years. And like, that's I think more than anything is what people really are attracted to. Me keeping it creative on a monthly basis, absolutely, that's kind of what it came down to. And there was definitely, like I mentioned, there was definitely that element of oversaturation. There was just the oversaturation in the scene, period, you know, just too much of it going on, and not in, it wasn't on my behalf. It definitely wasn't all like, oh, you guys are biting our shit. Like, it wasn't that at all. Cause we were not doing anything original. Like, we just weren't doing anything original. It just became too much of one thing. And oversaturation just takes away from the uniqueness, you know? So now where we're at now is just try to, my objective is to put together something that just feels a little bit more like an experience versus just like, hey, let's come out and support, you know, this. And, you know, not to say that the 5 years we did it beforehand wasn't like that too, because we had amazing shows too. But like, now it's way more about like the full show versus, you know, versus kind of like the basic version. Just trying to expand upon it a little bit. And, you know, it's important, man. Like, if people like to see this shit go down, if you want to support it, like, come out and support it. Like, genuinely support it. You know what I mean? If you like to see these things happen, dude, like, you have to support it. You got to show up. You got to put money into it. And you have to, you know, you got to spread the word and just kind of like be a part of the environment in order for it to work and sustain itself. And if that doesn't happen, then we don't really have much of this thing, you know. But I don't know. I'm blessed to definitely see it still going on to this day.
Thanks for hanging out with us this week. Of course, if you like the podcast, then there's a lot more out there. We have some articles and some blogs at www.thevinylexam.com. Of course, we're also on Facebook, Instagram, and maybe something else, but I'm not sure. We're also on Patreon, which we've talked about before, but we have a Patreon page. So if you want to check out what we're doing on the Patreon side, feel free to head on over there. On that note, special thanks to our official vinyl examiners, Brian Siebold and Yan Wong. And of course, to our executive producers, Janine Cuevas, Austell Gray, and Ben Lack. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time. You got